Now, bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades, this is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
Saw this story in the Daily News, and we wanted to talk to Mitch Englander about it. There's a company called Lime Bike, and it's largely centered out around Cal State Northridge. And this is a program that's been all over the country now. Major urban centers have these bike stands. They're kiosks, and you can put your credit card through, and you can pick up a bicycle.
I've seen it in downtown Dallas.
They're all over Santa Monica. They're all over the place. And you drop them off at another kiosk when you get to your destination, if there's one nearby. Lime Bike was different, where you could drop them off pretty much anywhere. People just leaving them in the sidewalk.
There's one on a bus stop by my house in Reseda.
To talk to us about this right now is the councilman for the San Fernando Valley, Mitch Englander. Good morning, Councilman Englander.
Good morning. I thought we were going to go high or low.
No, that's next week. You're a little early
next
on
week,
that.
Next.
Come back on next week.
So.
Nice sound effect. So this Lime Bike thing has really put a sour taste in everybody's mouth, quite frankly.
Yes.
And the fact that, yes. And they're leaving them not just in the middle of a sidewalk. I saw one laying down in a street blocking traffic 2 days ago in front of.
What kind of a business plan is this? I mean, how are these things, if there's, they're just going to be stolen?
It's not just stolen. I mean, they're causing, they're blocking the right of way. People in wheelchairs can't pass by the sidewalks. They're dumping on people's front lawns. They don't pick them up. It's crazy. There's no rules or regulations, and they literally just go in and set up shop without having any kind of permitting. I mean, it's gone rogue.
I just don't understand what the business model is. What do people have to put down to get physical possession of one of these things?
Well, there's an app, and I imagine you pay for it with your credit card, and you pay for the usage. And that's their business model. I mean, it just,
and then you could just literally leave it on a sidewalk in the middle of the road. And how does a company get their bicycle back?
They have GPS, so they go pick them up, and they have these scouts, I guess, that go pick them up, but they don't pick them up for sometimes 24 hours. And they're just left all over the place. I mean,
Jeez,
it just makes no,
our
no
kids,
practical sense.
We can't keep our bicycle when it's got locks on it for 24 hours in certain neighborhoods. So how in the world are these things just left in the open and not scooped up and, you know, they're in a homeless camp somewhere? Or
2 weeks ago, I actually drove by a homeless camp, and we were about to clean it up over on Winnetka by the theaters. We just cleaned that up 2 weeks ago. And on a Saturday, I drove to scout it out because we had the cleanup scheduled that week. And a guy literally had a Lime Bike in the middle of the street on Winnetka, and he was spray painting it black.
Yeah.
Really? Well, it's insanity.
Yeah, it really is.
So we need a moratorium. We need to stop this thing. We got to have some rules and regulations. The concept on paper is good. I mean, I think that whole first mile, last mile connectivity, having them on school campuses like CSUN makes sense. But not out in the community, and they shouldn't be able to leave campus, and they should have docks where they are stationed, where you know, the dockless bike programs, we don't have any problems with them, but these dockless things, they're just wrecking havoc on local communities, and so we need some rules to control these things.
Yeah, that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I mean, zero sense. How long will it take to fix this?
Hopefully pretty quickly. What I've asked is that my council members to come up with an emergency moratorium to stop all these docked bikes until we have rules and regulations, or unless some of the council members actually like the pilot programs they have going. Great. That's mildly interesting to me. Go ahead and go forward with the pilot programs if you support them in your community. But I don't, because we don't have the rules and regulations, and I'd rather have some kind of system and process to protect the public and our neighborhoods before going ahead with this massive experiment that doesn't seem to be working really well.
We're talking with LA City Councilman Mitch Englander, and you can follow on Twitter at @Mitch_Englander. Hey, while we got you here, what's going on with the trash monopoly investigation?
So, for you, I know you know this. I put in a motion last week to ask the city attorney to report back on how we can immediately get out of this exclusive franchise and go back to where we were. You know, we can continue to have the same goals of the program where we have clean fleets and we've cleaned up the industry, but they've quadrupled people's cash fees. There's failure to pick up. The customer service in many of these operators is dismal and horrible, and people are very frustrated, and it's very expensive to businesses. And so I've asked that that the city attorney report back immediately on trying to cancel and get out of these contracts that don't seem to be working. I think this is a complete failure, and the implementation plan by many of these operators has just fallen flat.
What happens if the answer is you can't get out of the contracts?
Well, then the question becomes, how do we hold them accountable to fix these fees, to fix the pickup? How do these – so one of the things in the contract, this really disturbs me, is that the city can fine these operators for missed pickups and all kinds of issues, but the actual businesses don't see those fines come back on their bills. In other words, they don't get a rebate if somebody fails to pick up their trash. They still get billed that trash pickup even though the operator didn't come pick it up, which makes – absolutely no sense. And so I want to turn out and fix some of these issues and make sure that we're in there fighting for businesses.
All right. Well, we'll continue to follow that story because there's a lot to talk about. And at some point, when you're ready, we'd love to talk to you about the drop program, too, because as a police reserve officer, I know that you're sort of the mayor's spokesperson has said, well, Mitch is asking the right questions and they should be answered. And there's a lot of questions to be asked about that.
Well,
one.
Yeah. And I'm happy to come back anytime on that. You know, real quickly, you know, as chair of public safety, I'm also on the personnel committee and as the pro tem of the council, I put in a motion looking at it, doing a deep dive on this. There's clearly waste and abuse and fraud in the system. And it's rampant. I mean, we just look in the raw numbers, and some of the stories that are coming out are horrific. And so not only cleaning that up, but actually going after and prosecuting the people that are committing fraud on the taxpayers. These are police officers and firefighters. And again, no matter how small or big those margins are, one is bad enough. And we're talking about potentially tens of millions of dollars over the years this has been going on. So I'm asking for not only forensic audits, but going and doing a deep dive and fixing this problem once and for all, because there's clearly some issues that have to be brought to the surface immediately.
All right. Well, we'll take you up on that. Thanks so much for being with us. Mitch Englander from the L.A. City Council, again, on Twitter, @Mitch_Englander. The insane road diet that was imposed on Venice Boulevard, Mar Vista, that whole community, and is scheduled to be rolled out in every district, every councilmanic district in the city of Los Angeles. And this is the deliberate, conscious effort to make traffic worse so that your commute will be so unbearable you'll say, Sacre bleu, I cannot handle my Fiat anymore, and I'll take a pogo stick to work in the morning. Well, the data is pouring in, and the data is not supporting that this is a safety benefit to society. Joining us right now to talk to us about this is the executive director of Safer Streets LA. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the show the man who actually knows what he's talking about, Jay Beaver. Jay, how are you?
Great. Great to be back, as always.
So, you know, we met a long time ago, Jay, with the red light camera shenanigans, and you proved to the LA Police Commission that not only to the red light cameras, are they a ripoff? They actually made intersections more dangerous, and you got rid of them in the city of Los Angeles. So you fought City Hall and actually won. City Hall claims that the road diets are going to make the streets safer, and in fact, they have made them the opposite.
That is true. That is true. And anybody who thinks about this for just a second will realize that taking away car lanes makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, especially on busy thoroughfares like Venice Boulevard. And, you know, we've gotten some data from at least the first 7 months so far of the road diet there, and we found that depending on how you look at it, all collisions are up somewhere between 20% and 24%, and all injury collisions are up somewhere between 43% and 58%. So this is not good. It's not good. And we also have some preliminary data that shows that collisions are also up on the side streets as well, which is what you would expect, because when you back up traffic on one road, traffic goes somewhere else and it goes onto the side roads where you don't want the traffic. And those get less safe as well. So those get more dangerous. And this is, you know, completely expected. This is not something that should be a surprise to anybody. And the people who are trying to impose this on us also realize that none of this makes sense, because it's driven by ideology. It's not really driven by logic and data. It's simply driven by the hatred of people who drive cars. It's a hatred of somebody who chooses to get in a car, go where they want to go, when they want to go, and they want to force you all onto the government-sponsored transit, which of course they make, they can pass out jobs for that. They can cut a ribbon when they open a new train or whatever. And that's what this is really all about. It's not about safety. It's really all about, telling you where you can go, when you can go, and how you should get there, the way the people who think that they know best how you should live your life, the overlords, the ones that you have elected to run your lives, basically, and have decided that's what should happen.
Or the ones who you didn't bother to vote against because you skipped the election altogether.
Right.
By the way, Mike Bonin, Councilman Mike Bonin, who represents that area, Mar Vista and Venice Boulevard, he told CBS 2 LA that his office, I should say, said Thursday night that they couldn't comment on the data, but they've compared numbers from before to after the installation. They say that the stretch is safer. They said that in the first 3 months after the changes were made, the traffic collisions, injuries, and speeding dropped. So we've got dueling data.
Well, not really, because when you look at their data and you look at our data is actually looking at collisions that occurred on the roadway, whereas their data is mixed in with a whole bunch of other nonsense that they put in there as well. And we looked at it because we asked for how they came up with their numbers, because this is something that they've been saying for a couple of months now. And I'm glad you asked me this question, because oftentimes what the public hears is, well, they said this and they said this and they don't know what to believe. So let me explain why their numbers show that there is a reduction. First thing that they did is they didn't just take the data that's on Venice Boulevard. They also included a couple of collisions on some of the side streets before in the before period. And they also compared some of the collisions. They also added in something called a counter report. And a counter report is when somebody walks into a police station and says, hey, I need to report something that happened on the street. Well, those are not necessarily accidents or whatever. So when they could be, you know, my bike was stolen, my car was keyed, all these other things. So when you look at the numbers from the collision database only, that is collisions that have happened on the roadway, you can see that collisions have increased. The number of injury collisions per month have increased. The rate has increased. And also, we should note that according to LADOT, that the traffic volume is down about 15%, which, again, you make the roads narrower, you're going to get less traffic on that road, or at least you're going to get less cars going able to go through there. So it's down about 15%, yet the collisions are higher. So you've reduced the number of vehicles that are traveling on the road, yet there are more collisions. So and the other thing is that the database that we're looking at, the numbers in the later part of the year, which is the after period, those numbers are not complete yet. So there may be even more collisions during the after period that we haven't even looked at yet. In fact, some of the local people down in that area have said that they have a couple of other collisions that do not show up yet in the database that they've documented on their own simply by living there. So my guess is when all the numbers come in, it's actually going to be even much worse than what we're reporting on now.
We're talking with Jay Bieber, who's the executive director of Safer Streets LA. SaferStreetsLA.org. That website, by the way, folks, you should bookmark. Make that a favorite of yours, because there's great information there. SaferStreetsLA.org.
And for this one, they should also go to Keep LA Moving as well.
Exactly. And it's not just LA. Our listener friend Ingrid just sent me a link to Pasadena Now. Orange Grove Boulevard from Lincoln to Sierra Madre Villa could be reconfigured to only one lane in each direction, according to the city of Pasadena's Department of Transportation. They contracted with the Arroyo Group, a Pasadena-based planning and urban design firm, to perform traffic analysis and put in buffered bike lanes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, we used to joke about this. I'm not anti-bicycle. Bicycles are they're wonderful exercise. They're great recreation. And in certain areas, they can be a viable form of commuting. But when you commingle bicycles with really busy roads, you are creating a safety hazard for both the bicyclists and for the motorists. And there are just some roads where the bicycles just don't belong. They're just and to take away lanes from cars in order to accommodate the bicycles because you have an ideological desire to get people out of their cars and you're punishing them for the sin of going to work and picking up their kids before and after school, dropping off their kids or picking up their kids after school, and shopping and conducting commerce is obscene. This isn't the reason that we elect people. And in my opinion, Jay, the Measure M dollars, which I supported and still support in principle because I believe that the long-term health of the area requires a massive investment in mass transit. The demographics are what they are. The projections are what they are. But they, once again, and this is why we don't trust these people, because they latched on to the word safety, because buried in the Measure M language on the ballot was, you know, mass transit projects, light rail, blah, 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 safety. And safety is a very broad term. So by including that, now they can justify taking lanes away from cars on safety. And of course, as you're pointing out, it not only isn't making the roads safer, it's actually making them more dangerous.
That's true. And are you saying to me that you're surprised that the politicians lied about about what they were serving up in one of their ballot measures that we should choose to tax ourselves? I mean, this is a constant thing with them. Yes, we should have transit in certain areas where it makes sense. We need transit through the Sepulveda Pass. We need transit that goes directly to the airport, to the major venues, to certain universities. Yes, there are places where transit belongs, but you are never, and let me make this clear, never going to be able to build enough transit to make it so people do not have to have a car and drive primarily in this area. It is too spread out. The housing is too spread out, and that is not going to change just by making it more dense in a couple of areas by transit. And it's not going to change by concentrating all of the jobs in one little place, because that's not going to happen. The jobs are spread out. Where people live is spread out, and you can never build enough transit to make it such that people will choose a train or a bus as their primary mode of transportation for most of those trips, unless they are lucky enough to live primarily on a transit line that goes from where they live to where they work. That they will take if it is faster, but for most of your trips and most of the time that you have to go someplace, the car is going to be a much more much better way of getting around, because it's going to be faster, it's going to be on demand, and there's not going to be delay in terms of having to wait for it, or it only goes in one direction where you want to go into three different stops along your route. And so people will always choose the form of transportation that is the most convenient, which is the fastest, and to some extent, which is the cheapest for them. And you would have to bankrupt the entire area for 20 or 30 years spending money on nothing else than building trains and transit and bus lines and whatever in order to make it such that people could actually live for any real length of time without a car. It is not going to happen. They're living in a fantasy world if they think that's the result of this.
Jay, one of the other wars against the private automobile is the war on parking. And this is, again, a lot of these ideas come from overseas where, you know, it's Holland. You can ride a bike, you know, or if you're, you know, who is it? Katie Couric, you can skate on a canal. But
yeah, right. cities that were built in the Middle Ages
or earlier. But the reality is that they're doing this in L.A. now, where they actually want developers to put less parking in their shopping malls and condo and apartment buildings, because if it's hard to park, it will be harder for people to drive their cars, and therefore they'll be taking fictitious buses and subways that don't exist.
It's all part and parcel of this new urbanism, this new ideology that all cities, no matter what they are currently, no matter what they look like historically, should all be gigantic, Manhattanized, like Manhattan Island, where everything is dense together, where people, you know, live somewhere and they walk downstairs and they go to a very expensive little shop to buy their groceries, and then, you know, for 2 days, and then they go home, and then two more days they walk downstairs and they get more stuff. I mean, this is these people's ideology, including our mayor, of what LA is
supposed to look like. Well, you mean including our next president of the United States.
Well, that depends on whether people learn about these kinds of things.
All right, Jay. Jay Bieber, SaferStreetsLA.org, and KeepLAMoving.com. Jay, as always, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. You have new technology, you end up with new problems. You end up with new virtues, but you also end up with new problems. And one of the things about one of the many issues that have come up in the wake of the digital universe are the not only alternate ways of transportation with Uber and Lyft, but also Airbnb and party houses where people can rent usually a very splendid house and oftentimes in the Hollywood Hills, and they're running it as a business, and it's become a plague on the neighbors.
You had the one with the lion in the house.
To talk to us about it right now, because the city council is finally pushing back against this. From the 4th District, the councilman from the Hollywood Hills area and a big swath of L.A. As a matter of fact, L.A. City Council member David Ryu. Good morning, Councilman Ryu. How are you?
Good morning. How are you guys?
We're fine. Thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. This is, you know, every once in a while people would have, or you'd get a bad neighbor that would have a lot of loud parties or behave in an unneighborly fashion. And it's bad enough when it's just somebody acting up who lives there, but it's particularly onerous when the owner of the house is actually running it as a business.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And this issue was first alerted to me several years ago when I first got elected, when I had frantic neighbors in a community in the Hollywood Hills call me because they actually saw a baby giraffe walking up the street.
I mean, it's funny until it's your house, you know, I mean, until it's your neighborhood. But part of the problem is not just the noise factor, but the Hollywood Hills is a unique neighborhood because the streets are narrow and there's a real genuine public safety issue here. This has been part of the problem of the Hollywood sign, and we wrestle with that as well, that with GPS systems now everybody can find their way up there, but it's a real hassle for the folks who live in the neighborhood. And for fire and first responders, somebody's got a party house going up there. There's shuttle vans taking people up and they're blocking the roads.
You're absolutely correct. And I just want to make it clear. I'm not talking about the everyday barbecues or family gatherings. I'm talking about these large, unruly, sometimes flyer parties where they even charge at the door, where, you know, they basically treat these homes like a nightclub on the Sunset Strip, when in actuality, it's a home in the Hollywood Hills.
So an ordinance has been passed. And it passed 15 to nothing. So what does the ordinance actually say?
The actual ordinance, the party house ordinance that we're referring to, is actually called a loud or unruly conduct ordinance. And this is after working for over a year and a half with LAPD, with the police department and our city attorneys to figure out how we could give them more enforcement mechanisms before and after. So what it does is it finally frees them up to be able to shut down these parties, but more importantly, go after them for a host of violations. So from the first offense to the sixth offense, the first offense is $100, the last offense is $8,000. But most importantly, the city attorney can now go after not just the host of the party, but the actual owner of the party, both or either or, as well as if they find it the gathering offensive enough that they could actually prosecute immediately.
We're talking with L.A. City Councilman David Ryu, and he represents the 4th Councilmanic District, which includes, of course, the Hollywood Hills, one of the more densely populated parts of the city and one of the more geographically challenging, as we mentioned, because of the S-turns and the narrow nature of the roads going through the Hollywood Hills. There's particular safety issues, especially given the threat of brush fires, etc. If we have a burn and the fire department can't get up the streets because somebody's decided to rent their house out to a, you know, a blowout party for cash, this is just not acceptable. It's incredible. It's the least neighborly thing you can do. You really have no regard for your neighbors if you're doing this.
Right. And it's not just during an emergency like a fire or a flood. You know, a lot of our first responders, LAPD and fire departments, responding to frivolous calls time after time, day after day for these parties, just to go check up or try to shut them down. So it's unnecessary time wasted for our first responders.
Well, when does the ordinance go into effect?
It goes into it just passed city council earlier this week. So it goes into effect immediately.
Okay, great. Well, listen, thanks for coming on. Talk to us about it, and you're always welcome on the show. We'd love to have you back to talk about, for instance, the Hollywood sign and that issue, as well as any other city issue you want to bring up.
I really appreciate that, and I will definitely take you up on that offer about the Hollywood sign.
Thanks for coming on, David Ryu from the L.A. City Council. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
95.5 KLOS.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
The state of California has given the green light to driverless vehicles. Driverless cars will be tested in California for the first time. Now, we've had driverless cars on the road, but this time it's driverless cars without a backup driver. And to talk to us about this right now is Consumer Watchdog President Jamie Court. Jamie, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, great to be here. Thanks, Doug.
So you're not a big fan of this idea.
Well, look, we've been following these robot cars for quite a while, and years ago, when they approved these testing regulations on California roads, we made sure we got reports, public reports, about when the cars were driving, and we had these human test drivers in these cars, which was a condition of testing. The reports of when the computer disengages and the human driver has to take over, you know, we made them public. We did it through a Public Records Act request. The Department of Motor Vehicles said we'll make them public, and we've got the latest batch of reports from the testing last year, just came out in January, and they show that these cars, in the best case circumstances, robot cars, can't go more than 5,600 miles without a disengagement, meaning a human driver takes over. In most cases, that's the best case, that's Waymo, Google's company. In most cases, they can't go a couple of hundred miles without a human driver taking over because there's a pothole, there's weather, there's a software deficiency, there's a hardware deficiency. There's just something that wasn't mapped on the roads. These cars are not ready to drive themselves. I mean, that's the lesson of this report. And yet, to rush these cars to the road because the Silicon Valley's really been pushing and Governor Brown's been pushing and everybody wants California to be the first, we now have a situation where car companies can apply for a permit to test and have a remote driver. In other words, like a video game driver in Mountain View, California, Google's home headquarters, there to watch these robot cars that don't have the test drivers with them go down the roads. And if something goes wrong, allegedly, on a remote control basis, you know, somebody who's like playing a video game with the car can stop the car remotely. Now, I just don't think that's going to work. I think people are going to get hurt. I think there may be deaths because when you're in a car and you're a test driver, you can see dangers peripherally. You can see it. You're alert. You're sensing it. And you go in and you take over. You can't, you know, it's a one-dimensional thing when you're watching, you know, as a remote driver. Who knows if these remote drivers are going to be watching more than one car? I think it's a big mistake because the technology has a lot of promise. But if we rush it to the roads, if there's death, if there's injury, these are cars operating among pedestrians, cyclists. It's going to kill the technology. And it's just foolhardy to do this, but the state, the politicians in the state are rushing to answer the pleas of the Silicon Valley and to keep up with states like Arizona, where they're doing this. we in L.A. and San Francisco have a lot more congestion on our streets than they do in rural Arizona, and these cars cannot handle it.
And the roads are in worse shape here, and that is an issue, too. We're talking about Jamie Court, Consumer Watchdog President, consumerwatchdog.org. You know, this technology has been floating around for a while, and you can watch some amazing videos. You can watch big rigs, and I've seen this video, an 18-wheeler back into a loading dock between two other trucks with no driver on board. But all of these are under basically ideal conditions. And the actual real-world experience of driving on our crowded roads is anything but ideal. We've got all kinds of issues, including idiots like me on the road. So, but at some point, Jamie, in order for this technology to be to have a utilitarian function instead of just being an oddity and a curiosity, it has to be tested under actual road conditions. So how do they go about doing that? You know, there always has to be a first time to do something. Somebody's got to be the first person to, for instance, you know, do brain surgery. And, you know, somebody, the Wright brothers had to jump off those hills at Kitty Hawk, you know, knowing that the thing that they were jumping off of wasn't right. But they had to figure it out by actually riding it.
Hey, we can see whether people who aren't licensed as doctors or robots can do brain surgery. But that first patient's going to be a guinea pig.
Yep.
And we are guinea pigs on the roads, man. You know, pedestrians, cyclists, other drivers, we know from the disengagement reports that, look, you can test these cars with a human driver there. The human driver does not have to take over the steering wheel, the brake. They don't have to intervene. But they have, because they've sensed dangers, and they have to publish these reports with the state. If you go to consumerwatchdog.org, you can look at the type of circumstances when they take over. I mean, these are not, you know, serious situations. We're talking about ambulances coming out of nowhere. We're talking about bicyclists appearing. We're talking about, like, trees that are hanging too far into the road. I mean, these robot cars don't have the intelligence of human drivers. They don't have the awareness. But the biggest thing that really trips them up is the human drivers, because they can't anticipate human behavior. And so we're putting these robot cars on the roads with human drivers. If we put them on a carpool lane dedicated on the 405 where there are only robot cars, and pretty soon we are going to have vehicle-to-vehicle communications, they'll be able to talk to each other, it's a much safer circumstance. Or even trucks, actually, that do this in the middle of the country, where they have a driver in the first truck and the rest of them kind of have a fleet, and they have robots in the middle. You know, that is the way to test this technology gradually. But what we're going to have is these really crazy ethical situations that are going to test our human values, frankly. We're going to see, like, you know, a situation where a kid's got a ball in the middle of the road, running after the ball, a young kid, and you're going to have a Mercedes that's robot car driven coming down the road, and that car is going to have to make a decision. Do I swerve and potentially, likely, kill the occupants of the car, or I just go straight and kill the kid? Now, Mercedes is going to make that programming decision. If it was, I hope, 9.9 out of 10 Americans, we would swerve to save the kid. That type of situation is going to be repeated on our roads time and again if we let these robot cars on the roads without knowing the algorithms that program them, without mandating the ethical decisions they're going to make, without making sure we have the safety protocols. And it's not just me saying this. It's the CEO of Ford, for instance, who said, we can't go this fast until we figure that all out. Well, almost the rest of the entire industry, from General Motors to Waymo to Mercedes, which has already said we prioritize the occupants in our cars when we do this programming, these companies are saying, no, let's go. We got to test them. We're going to have less deaths than with human drivers, and that is their standard. But the question is, who's going to die and how, and does that jive with our rules and our laws and our ethical customs and our social mores? I mean, make no mistake, this is a test about our values. And all the politicians in Sacramento are just putting their thumb in the wind and waiting for the Silicon Valley campaign contributions, and they are not paying attention to safety. And it could be, in 5 years, we're having a conversation about this being one of the biggest scandals we've ever seen.
Well, it's a fascinating subject, because there has been a paradigm shift in our society in terms of what is an acceptable level of risk. For instance, before the invention of safety glass, which we all have in our automobiles now, where, you know, if you're an idiot, you're not wearing your seatbelt and your head goes into the windshield, the windshield shatters into 10 million little beads, where previously it used to be plate glass. And if your head went through the windshield, I'm going to be graphic here for a second, people were decapitated, not by going through the windshield, but when you'd snap back, that's when the windshield would cut your head off. And amazingly, in the teens, when the Model Ts ruled the roads in the early 1920s, people accepted this as, well, what are you going to do? They love the freedom. It's like the way Americans and the world, frankly, is willing to forfeit privacy because we just like the digital convenience that all of these new devices afford us. And we know that we forfeited our privacy every time we go everywhere. We're being monitored and tracked and traced. And people yawn and say, yeah, I don't like that, but I love being able to swipe my card and being able to not have to have cash on me or whatever the hell it is. But I do think when it comes to safety, we really do expect to live forever. And I don't know that the public is willing to embrace a technology that has such an inherent risk built into it today, as opposed to where we were, you know, in a previous generation. We were more fatalist, I think.
Most Americans, according to the polls, don't trust these robot cars. They're gaining acceptance. They're gaining acceptance partially because these other institutions are legitimizing them. And they will gain acceptance if we go slow enough and if we do it correctly, which is to create a separate infrastructure where they're not in the city streets until the city streets, which have a lot of variables that these cars can't keep up with, you know, are figured out. We do it on a dedicated infrastructure on rural roads, on dedicated carpool lanes when the cars have the vehicle-to-vehicle communication. But we're talking, these car companies want to get these cars on the roads by 2019, and they're going to plant them first, kind of like a taxi cab service, in, we call them geofenced areas, in urban areas like L.A., in areas like San Francisco. And that's where you're going to see the injuries and the deaths, because there are so many just cyclists and pedestrians and things that a car can't be programmed to expect. And by doing it that way, I think when you see a software failure or a cyber attack, which is a real problem, we're going to see this technology hopefully shut down until it's figured out. And that will really delay it. So I think there's people in the industry who are saying, do this the right way. But there is the profit motive that is sending Uber and Waymo and these other companies
right
onto the street right now.
Yeah, well, Uber and Lyft and all of the Waymo and all of the ride-sharing services, they want to be able to have driverless cars patrolling the roads with no drivers in them so that they don't have to pay the drivers. All the people
exactly
right now are paying their bills, or their side gig is picking up some extra dough driving for Lyft or Uber, know that your employer is doing everything they can to replace you. Hey, Jamie, thank you so much for being with us. We always appreciate your insights into stuff. ConsumerWatchdog.org, an important website. Consumer Watchdog President Jamie Court. Thanks, sir. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Doug.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, it was 35 degrees when I got in the car this morning to come down here. And one of the things that I thought about is, man, this is not a good time to be living on a sidewalk or in an alley or in a river wash. I was happy to see that I still have the ability to gin up some empathy for the homeless, because it's a tough issue. On the one hand, it's just horrible. It's a horrible way of life. It's a horrible situation that people find themselves in or put themselves in. But then again, it's also a horrible indictment of society that we've allowed it to happen. And it's finally been brought to an end along the Santa Ana River Wash, that huge dystopian Blade Runner kind of like encampment that we've all seen has been emptied finally. And wait till you hear what it was emptied of. Joining us right now to talk about it is the Anaheim City Councilwoman Chris Murray. Welcome back, Councilwoman Murray.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Great to join you this morning.
So, congratulations. It took 10 years, but it's been done. It's finally been emptied out.
Well, it's actually only been a couple years, but it certainly feels that long. It was a Herculean effort to shelter 700 people in roughly 10 days, but it was an enormous team effort led by the cities in the County of Orange in particular, and Judge Carter's leadership as the federal judge overseeing the case for the past couple of years.
Who actually did the work? Because 1,100 pounds of human waste were carted out of there, 5,000 hypodermic needles. And this,
right,
by the way, And the key word was, this is a Fox News report, was so far. So, you know, it was still in process. So a lot more than 1,100 pounds of human waste and more than 5,000 hypodermic needles. Who did that work?
Well, over 100 employees, the County of Orange, have been working around the clock for the past 2 weeks. It has been led by the county as well as the Orange County Sheriff's Department and a number of service providers like CityNet, who's our nonprofit, both for the city of Anaheim and the County of Orange, who are down there providing case management along with the social services provided by the county.
Got it. Now, one of the U.S. District Court Judge David Carter had originally put a hold on this cleanup, and then he literally went to the river himself, saw it with his own eyes, negotiated the deal that ended up putting people with month-long motel vouchers, and that was what unlocked the temporary stay. The question I think we all have is, what happens on day 31? What happens when the month-long vouchers expire? Where do the people who were evicted from the river go?
Well, you know, and just as an unfortunate note in all of this is, because of the number of motel vouchers that were provided, which was a necessity to make sure people truly had structural shelter in order to clear these encampments, but there were a number of other service offerings provided, including expanded beds at our full-service shelter in Anaheim, and those weren't accepted because the preference was motel shelter. We also had a number of rehabilitation facilities, over 20 beds opened up on scholarship, that weren't accepted either. So once that 30 days is up, the county is working to do a clinical assessment of every individual we've placed, and we'll be working to really connect them to appropriate facilities, whether it's mental health, alcohol recovery and detox, recuperative care, or any specialized need they have. So it will be an ongoing process. Anaheim, the county, and all 34 cities, quite frankly, in the County of Orange are working through the Association of California Cities in Orange County to create 2,700 permanent supportive housing units in Orange County over the next 3 years. So there's a vast effort. Really, the journey starts now. The hard work starts now. But we have effectively cleared those encampments because they were not safe, as you know, for those living there or the communities that are adjacent to those encampments.
We're talking with Chris Murray, who's the Anaheim City Councilwoman. And, you know, what, you know, how does Anaheim stop people from coming back to the river? How does it not fill up again?
Well, when structural changes are happening, there will be hours of operation that the county is putting in place, along with fencing and additional security. The county and the city of Anaheim, as well as the cities of Orange and other neighboring cities, have anti-camping, anti-loitering policies that will be fully enforced. You know, the goal here is to provide that concurrent service. We are going to provide shelter and true recuperative care to those who are suffering and those who are homeless. But we will not allow public safety to diminish in our communities any longer. So it is a dual approach. It is a concurrent approach to make sure that we're providing public law and order for all individuals, those who are homeless as well as those who are housed, and attempting to raise their families in a safe and secure environment in our city.
Well, you know, we all know that this is, first of all, it's not just an Anaheim problem. It's a national problem, and it's a particularly California problem. But there is an element of whack-a-mole here, and this is part of the problem. As long as people refuse services, and as you sadly pointed out, a lot of the services that were offered were declined in lieu of just taking the motel vouchers, which certainly gets people temporary shelter, but it doesn't really deal with any of the underlying issues.
Are there any rules for the motel vouchers?
You know, the rules are limited to just what every individual has to follow when you stay in a motel or hotel. I mean, you have to follow basic laws and sanitary conditions. And then there's also, you know, that care, that continuum of care that's being provided by the County of Orange with the case management. So each individual is not being isolated in a motel room, but really getting that ongoing social service connection. So the Board of Supervisors and county staff have been really engaged in making sure this is a comprehensive program and not just, you know, just moving people into to motels for expediency purposes, but truly to help. And so once that 30 days is up, their option is really going to be going into an appropriate type of care. They will not be allowed to just go back to the streets. That's not the option. So the portfolio of all of those opportunities, whether it's veterans, our emancipated foster kids, those who are dealing with alcohol addiction or drug addiction, we are putting together, and the mental health treatment beds as well. We're going to put together the entire line of care and services that are needed to make sure that once that 30 days is up, they have an appropriate place to go that will help meet their unique and individual needs.
A last question, Councilwoman Murray. How many of the people evicted from the Riverwash were Prop 57 refugees? In other words, people who had been released from jail on Prop 57.
You know, I don't have the exact percentage with me right now. I will tell you that there's no question that Propositions 47 and 57, where people are being early paroled onto the community streets, yeah, the prison overcrowding issue has certainly improved for the state, but what it's done is impact every community, and every community in California is dealing with it, and that definitely needs to be reformed. We had significant parolees in the last 3 months since Anaheim adopted Operation Home Safe to really call for that crisis and response to the riverbed. Over 500 individuals have been arrested for real criminal activity, human trafficking and prostitution and drug use. There was a real criminal issue an element down there, and we had to address that and tackle it together as a community, and we did. But the cities need relief from the state on that one because it is having an impact in our communities.
All right. Thank you so much. Always appreciate it. Councilwoman Chris Murray from Anaheim. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.